Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RZVS Specialist in Zoo and Wildlife Medicine, David Perpignan. Thank you, David. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, thank you. And hello, and welcome to this webinar that is going to show all the information a veterinary nurse needs to know when working with reptile patients. The work with reptiles and with any other exotic animal is becoming a common thing in many veterinary practices, and both veterinary surgeons and veterinary nurses need to be comfortable dealing with these species. All right, let me see. It's very important that nurses know some basics about identification and sex determination of the most common reptile species presented to the veterinary surgery. In order to give telephone advice, in order to better know how to keep them and how to feed them during hospitalization, or in order just to follow the written instructions of the veterinary surgeon. Let's start with tortoises, and we'll also talk just a bit about turtles. Mediterranean tortoises are commonly kept in the UK. There is a tradition of decades of keeping these species from Southern Europe and Northern Africa, as you can see in the map. However, that doesn't mean these species are well adapted to the British climate. Two species are commonly kept, the Hermann's tortoise and the Greek tortoise or Sporthid tortoise. The key to differentiate these species is the supracaudal scute of the carapace, as you can see here in number one, which is divided in two in the Hermans and unique in the Greek. Also, there is a nail at the tip of the tail in the Hermans tortoise, as we can see here in number two. The spores or tubercles that are present between the tail and the back legs are significantly more prominent in the Greek or Sporthid tortoise. If we take a look at this picture, we can see the tail here. And therefore, what species is this? Well, there is a nail at the tip of the tail, so this is a Hermann's tortoise. Another species that is commonly seen is the Russian tortoise, which is smaller and very round, so you can grab it with your hands like a hamburger. Russian tortoises have only four claws, and they don't have a hinge in the plastron, which is, the plastron is the lower part of the shell. Basically, the shell is formed by the plastron, which is the lower part, and the carapace, which is the upper part. Hermans in Greek have five toes and a hinge in the plastron. So these are Russian tortoises, and we can see they don't have that hinge in the plastron. This is another Russian tortoise. Note that it's quite round. Sometimes, and this is common in the UK, tortoises have skeletal abnormalities, skeletal deformities because of the diet or because the lack of access to UV light, etc. In these cases, identifying the species may be more difficult if you are used to tell them apart just by looking at them. I mean, just by having a lot of experience. This is another Russian tortoise, also with some skeletal abnormalities affecting the scutes of the carapace. There are some other species that can come to clinic for veterinary care. The African spore tortoise is one of them. This is a large tortoise, easily weighing between 25 and 50 kilograms. They come from Africa and originally live in semi-desertic areas. The leopard tortoise is another species originating in Africa. It is intermediate in size between the sulcata or African spore tortoise and the Mediterranean tortoises. The South American red-footed tortoise is also seen in private practice. However, the most common species are always the Mediterranean species, the Hermans, the Greek, and the Russian. Telling apart male from female tortoises is not difficult when they are adults. In most species, females are larger, have shorter tails, and the plastron is flat. Males, such as the one on the left, have long tails, and the plastron here is concave. This is a close-up of the same picture to appreciate the difference in the size of the tail between male and females. And these are the very same animals showing that males have a concave plastron. This is a sulcata or African sport tortoise, and we can see the concave plastron. This is a male. Sometimes this feature is difficult to see in pictures, but it's easier when we have the animal with us and we can actually palpate that area. These are Egyptian tortoises, another species of Mediterranean tortoises not that common in captivity. We can see how females are larger than males. Turtles are less commonly presented as patients, and one of the most common species has been for years the red-eared slider. Telling apart males from females is difficult in young animals, but relatively easy in adult ones. Again, females are larger than males, and males have very long nails. Males of any chelonian, and chelonia is the order, including tortoises and turtles, have a penis or a phallus that sometimes they exteriorize, making evident the sex of the animal, of course. Lizards are also commonly kept in captivity, and the most commonly seen is the bearded dragon that originates from Asia and Australia. Bearded dragons have spiny scales on the body and on the head, and these needs to be considered when handling these animals. The beard, or the area of the throat, turns dark when the animal is stressed. Overall, the whole animal also turns dark with stress or even disease. Sexing adult bearded dragons is easy, as males have prominent femoral and preanal pores. Those pores are less, let's take another look at those pores. Those pores, as we can see in the female on the left, they're not very prominent in females, but they're quite prominent in males. In addition, males have two hemipenes, which make a bulge in the base of the tail, but this is more difficult to see in the picture. Here we can see a male. Take a look at the prominent pores. And we are pressing the ventral base of the tail to express what we call the seminal plugs, which are typical in males that do not reproduce. I mean, they do not have contact with females. Water dragons are sometimes seen in private practice, but they don't really adapt very well to captivity, as they constantly hit the glass of the terrarium and develop mouth infections. Among the chameleons, the veiled chameleon is the most common one. Males have intense color and a taller crest, while females have duller colors and less prominent crest. The color of chameleons can vary depending on the mood, depending on the time of the year, of the reproductive status, etc. Chameleons and other species of lizards can be sexed just by taking a look at them, especially when we have some experience. However, they also have some common things with other lizards. Take a look at this picture. This is actually a thin chameleon where the right back leg has actually been amputated, as we can see here. We can see the cloaca, which is just the opening to the reproductive, urinary, and intestinal tracts. We can see two hemipenes, and when they fall back, they are located in the ventral aspect of the base of the tail, right here. And we can also see seminal plugs coming out of each hemipin. Iguanas were once very popular, but now they are actually not. They were difficult to keep, and they were big animals as adults. The way to sex iguanas is very similar to what we've seen in other species. Leopard geckos are common in captivity, and they originate from the desertic areas of Iran. Sexing geckos is similar to do it in any other species of reptile. They have preanal pores that are more developed in males, and the base of the tail of males contains the hemipenis. So it is a bit more bulging, that area is more bulged than in females. Here we can see the exteriorized hemipenis of a gecko. That's a different species, not a leopard gecko. Snakes can also be seen in captivity, although they are less commonly presented than tortoises or lizards. The corn snake is a common species that originates from North America. The boa constrictor is also, or red-tailed boar, is also common and originates from South America. All the species of pythons and boas can also be seen in captivity. It is uncommon to see venomous species in private practice, and they need to be referred to a specialist willing to see them. Never work with those dangerous species. It's definitely not worth it. Sexing snakes is a bit more challenging than sexing other reptiles. Some species of boars and pythons have spurs at the site of the cloaca, which are more developed in males. And for most species, the way to sex snakes, and you can sex some lizards too this way, is to insert a probe, usually a metallic probe, specially designed for these, but it can be any probe or even a flexible catheter or a tube. We should insert the probe caudally on the lateral aspect of the cloaca with plenty of lubrication. In males with hemipenis, the probe can be inserted usually more than 6 caudal scales. In females, usually less than 4. So, in this example, if the probe only penetrates a length of 3 scales, then it is a female. However, this was actually a male, and the probe could be inserted for more than 6 scales. In addition, the spurs are well developed, and this white substance here, let me see, these are the spurs. Now, that's the white substance, that's actually sperm, obtained after massaging the body of the animal. And this is the spur. In order to advise owners and to provide the needs for hospitalized patients, some basic knowledge of husbandry is necessary. And the most important aspects are those related to heat, light, photo period, humidity, substrate, space, and diet. Reptiles are ectothermic, that is, cold-blooded animals, and they rely on external heat sources to maintain the body temperature. Without that maintenance of the body temperature, reptiles cannot develop the biochemical and physiological functions. Reptiles do well when kept within their activity temperature range or optimum temperature range. There are actually several names to refer to this. Reptiles can absorb heat through radiation, by exposure to the heat waves of the sun, or by conduction, by getting in contact with a hot surface, such as rocks. And they lose heat by convection, which is just by being in contact with air that is colder than the body temperature. Some reptiles get the heat by radiation, and some others do it by conduction. For example, nocturnal species such as this copperhead, which I photographed in a road, as roads maintain heat at night. This is a representation of the preferred temperature of reptiles. TS, or ATR, is what we've mentioned of activity temperature range or optimum temperature range. It means that the reptile would be fine if maintained at that range. And for most reptiles, we can say more or less that the range is between 25 and 30 degrees Celsius, which is 77 to 88 degrees Fahrenheit. And in order to provide that range, we use primary and secondary sources of heat. With the primary, we heat the area to the lower end of the range, usually about 24 or 25 degrees Celsius. We do that with a heat mat, a heat plate, a radiator, etc. And the secondary source heats a focal area to the higher end of the range, usually starting at 30 degrees Celsius, depending on the species. We provide this secondary source usually as a basking point. By providing external heat, we can actually burn the animal if we are not careful. For example, placing a basking point with a heat lamp too close to the animal. In addition, if we provide a basking point but do not heat with a primary source, anything outside the basking point can be too cold for the reptile, and the animal will prefer to stay at the basking point constantly, therefore increasing the chances of burns. Hot rocks are dangerous, as they can malfunction, and also buried cables are not recommended for those species that can dig and can get in contact with the cables or with a heat mat that is too hot. We need to remember that the thermometer is always necessary and that most problems arise from not controlling the lowest and highest temperature, or when the enclosure is too small and the reptiles cannot have a gradient of temperature from which to choose from. In addition, reptiles should have places to hide in order to better regulate the temperature, their temperature. This is a chameleon kept in poor husbandry conditions, without proper heating. When the animal was placed in an incubator at the right temperature, it climbed to the top of the terrarium, as the heat was coming from the top, and turned half of its body dark in order to better absorb heat. That was an indication that the chameleon was in a desperate need for proper heat. There are special thermometers for terrariums, and those are usually good, as they provide maximum and minimum temperatures, and they can record temperature inside and outside of the terrarium. Lighting is also very important for reptiles. Photoperiod is a key aspect for reproduction, but this is not that important when we hospitalize an animal. However, ultraviolet light is very important in order to prevent common skeletal problems, such as metabolic bone disease, where the bones become soft due to the lack of calcium. Let's remember that ultraviolet light activates vitamin D, which is responsible for the absorption of calcium. Soft mandibles and soft and bended bones, as we can see in this chameleon, are commonly seen with this disease. is another example with a tortoise. Let's see a video here. Let me see, I cannot see the video. Now, all right. It was just in my computer. It was a bit slow, probably. So can you see how the plastron of this Russian tortoise can be easily depressed? It's completely soft. That is metabolic bone disease. The best way to provide ultraviolet light is through direct sunlight. This is not always possible, and in addition, ultraviolet light does not penetrate glass or plastic. So, for example, if there is a window between the sun and the reptile, this one will not get any ultraviolet light. So the solution to this problem is to provide artificial UV light through special fluorescent tubes or mercury vapor lamps. The problem with these devices is that they need to be close to the animal for proper UV emission, for proper ultraviolet light emission. For example, most fluorescent tubes are ineffective if the reptile is not within 30 to 50 centimeters from the source. The emission of UV light also diminishes with time in these devices, and the device can stop emitting UV light while still emitting visible light. And that's why it is recommended to change every more or less 6 months. And these are some examples of lamps, bulbs, and fluorescent lights that provide UV light. And finally, let's remind that UVB is the kind of UV light important for the absorption of calcium. Humidity is another aspect that we need to provide to our patient, and humidity levels will be different according to the species. Higher levels are necessary for animals originating from humid environments, but also for those animals that are shedding. Let's remind that reptiles change their skin on a regular basis, and more often when they are actively growing. The old skin turns white, as we can see in the head of this gecko, and then separates from the underlying new skin. At this time, humidity should be higher, so the layers of skin separate better. Here we can see a chameleon shedding. In snakes that are about to shed, the eye turns bluish as they stop, and they stop feeding because they cannot see. And that blue color is actually liquid between the old layer of skin and the new layer of skin. Humidity is provided using mist or fog machines, artificial rain, dripping systems, waterfalls, or just by placing the water bowl close to the heat source to produce evaporation. Ventilation and humidity can work against each other. If we ventilate a lot, humidity will get low. If we sacrifice ventilation in order to have high humidity, we may produce problems with lack of ventilation, particularly in snakes. This python looks like it's been burned, but actually, it is a skin infection caused by the combination of lack of ventilation, lack of space, animals sitting constantly on its feces and urine, and heat coming from the lower part of the terrarium. The substrate we place the animal on is also important. It should be non-toxic, digestible, or too big to eat. And of course, for us in the clinic, it should be easy to clean and to change. When the reptile is in a hospital, the best thing to do is the use of paper towels or newspaper, as it is clean, easy to dispose, etc. Reptiles may ingest substrate incidentally with their food or as a result of pica, which is the abnormal behavior of eating food that is not actually nutritional. Reptiles can ingest the substrate, and gastrointestinal obstruction is not uncommon. That's why during hospitalization, we should only provide substrate that is digestible or impossible to eat. This is an example of a necropsy of an iguana that died from intestinal perforation due to ingestion of inadequate substrate made of brood pieces. These are just some examples of what to use and what not to use. The list is relative, but we know that newspaper or paper towels are easy to clean and safe, but sand or gravel cause most problems of gastrointestinal obstruction seen in practice with reptiles. Reptiles need water in order to drink and in order to keep humidity in the environment. Some reptiles, such as snakes, should be able to submerge in a bowl of water, and this actually encourages the animal to urinate and defecate. Some species, such as chameleons, will only take water directly from the leaves of the terrarium, so we'll need to provide a dripping system. Let's take a look at this video. This is a snake drinking water. It was a snake without access to water for weeks. So know that they can drink actually a considerable amount of water when thirsty. Reptiles can be classified as herbivores, carnivores, and omnivores, but the feeding of each individual species will be different. Due to the intrinsic metabolism of reptiles, and due to the fact that most reptiles in captivity do little exercise, we need to prevent obesity. And remember that many adult animals do not need to eat every day, or even every week in the case of large snakes. Obesity has become an important problem in some species, such as bearded dragons and snakes. This is just an example of a snake eating a dead mouse, and this is a giant tortoise eating its salad. We will not go into much detail of what diets are indicated for each species. That's beyond the scope of this webinar. And all these husbandry issues are important to keep our patient healthy, such as this bearded dragon with a healthy and active posture. And because many, many, many of the problems we'll see in practice are related to poor husbandry. This is an example, giving live prey to snakes, and some of them can get mutilated by the mouse or rat. So it's better to feed snakes with dead prey. In the UK, it's actually illegal to feed them with live prey. That's another husbandry property, a hibernation area, and then rats can get into the tortoise and chew at its legs. Or providing temperatures that are too low, which predispose reptiles to all kinds of infections, such as this otitis in a red-eared slither. Or, as we've mentioned, obesity by feeding too much or by feeding the wrong diet. This is the liver of a lizard with hepatic lipidosis. So basically, the liver is kind of yellow and is completely infiltrated by fat. Restraining patients is an important task of the veterinary nurse. Let's start this section explaining how to handle snakes. Most species of snakes kept in captivity are docile, such as corn snakes. Therefore, we will restrain the animal very loose, supporting its body and allowing it to move freely so we can actually appreciate coordination, strength, etc. Similar in here, we handle loosely and the snake can have some range of movement. Only when we need to do something more specific, such as the examination of the mouth, we will restrain the snake carefully by the back of the head, always supporting the weight of its body. Sometimes, for larger snakes, two people are necessary for restraining. And we will proceed to open the mouth with something soft, such as a credit card or a kitchen rubber spatula. The technique of mild and loose restraint may not be applied with dangerous species, such as this green boar. With these species, we'll need to do a proper immobilization, restraining the head and supporting the body, as these species can always, or they will always try to bite. For more complicated and dangerous species of snake, and for those that are venomous, there is a range of specialized tools particularly designed for safe restraining. Most chelonians are easy to handle for examination. Again, we need to use a gentle technique and allow some movement. When a specific procedure needs to be done, such as blood collection, then we need to apply more restraining, holding the legs inside the shell. Here we are pulling the head out by holding just caudal to the skull. This is the only way to properly examine the mouth of a tortoise. And here we're doing the same, but to place a Doppler to monitor heart function. This is a red-eared slider. But most terrestrial tortoises won't bite. This is a snapping turtle, a very dangerous species, and therefore we need to block the head in order to proceed with the examination. The restraining of lizards is similar. We may allow the animal to sit on our hand while we visually examine it, as we can see in this picture. But when we need to do something more specific, we'll need to immobilize them by the pelvis and the shoulder. So with one hand, we immobilize head and front legs, while with the other, we immobilize back legs and the base of the tail. Some animals, such as big iguanas, can cause harm with their tail, so we need to be careful. For medium to larger reptiles, two people may be necessary to properly restrain the animal. And here we are restraining a water dragon by holding the head. Every time we hold the head in a reptile, we need to support the body. Some lizards, such as geckos, can break their tail in stressful situations or when the animal is grabbed by the tail. We should never hold a reptile by its tail, and we need to be far more delicate with geckos. This is a large iguana, a species that can harm the nurse or the surgeons with its nails and with its tail. Applying pressure over the eyes calms down some reptiles. And this is what we're doing here. We place cotton or swabs over the eyes and bandage everything together around the head. So those pieces of cotton or gauze are putting pressure over the eye and the animal calms down. We can use this technique to take a radiograph, take a blood sample, etc. The veterinary nurse should be able to collect blood from most reptiles. In lizards and snakes, we generally take a blood sample from the ventral tail vein. We place the reptile on dorsal recumbency, disinfect the area, then we insert the needle in the midline until it touches the ventral surface of the of a caudal vertebra. We withdraw a bit the needle and the vein is found. Collection should be gentle and slowly in order to optimize sample quality. Some people recommend cardiac punction to get blood sample in a snake, as taking a blood sample from the ventral caudal vein may be difficult in some animals. I personally prefer to avoid inserting a needle into the heart due to the damage produced. If there is no other option, then the snake should be properly restrained or even sedated or anesthetized. In order to find the exact location of the heart, take a look at this video. We need to watch carefully the ventral scales of the first half of the body and see how they move rhythmically. In that area, the heart will be situated. Of course, we can also use a Doppler to find the heart, if we have one. In chelonians, the dorsal tail or dorsal coccygeal vein is commonly used to collect a blood sample. It is easier in males as they have long and thick tails. This is another example in a red-eared slider, and you can see that it is actually another male with long and thick tail. We need to be able to grab the tail with our hand. If the tail is not big enough, then we'll need to use other technique. One of them is the subcarpaceal vein, located ventral to the midline of the carapace. In order to sample it, we need to insert the needle in the midline, in the area of skin next to the carapace, over the head, and direct the needle towards the vein. The jugular is more difficult to locate. This technique is usually unsuccessful in aquatic turtles, but can be used with terrestrial tortoises. It is a blind stick. You cannot really see the jugular, or many times even palpate it. Very different from what happens with dogs, cats, and other animals. There are other techniques that are uncommonly used. For example, the brachial vein, which is associated to the tendons of the front leg. But it's not easy to find. Of course, I have used the pictures where I could find it, but many times you try and you don't even find the vein. The sinus is an easy way to get blood, but I only use it to inject euthanasia solution. I don't like to take a blood sample from a site so close to the brain. It's dangerous. In turtles, it is better to bend the head to avoid the long occipital process of the skull. In this position, if we advance the needle too much, we can see easily that we'll get into the brain. And that's why I only use this technique for euthanasia. Once we've collected the blood sample in heparin, and at least in chelonians it needs to be in heparin, while in other reptiles EDTA is fine for hematology, then once we've collected that sample, we need to do a blood smear. And this technique, the technique of two glass slides at an angle, is the simplest one. We can see how to perform it in the video. and identification of the blood cells under the microscope can also be a task developed by the veterinary nurse. Reptiles have nucleated red blood cells, and we can also find heterophils, heterophil is the equivalent of the mammalian neutrophil. In reptiles, we can also find monocytes, eosinophils, basophils, platelet or thrombocytes, also nucleated, and lymphocytes. Thrombocytes are usually found aggregated, as we can see in this picture. When they are not aggregated, their morphology is a bit different. They are larger and have more cytoplasm. Basophils are commonly found in some species, and they can be strongly basophilic, or they can lose the granules, as we can see in this picture, and therefore they look like cells with a halo. In many species, heterophils have darker borders in the cytoplasm and a halo around the nucleus, particularly in turtles and tortoises. In other species, such as in this bearded dragon, heterophils may look a bit different. And also lymphocytes may exhibit some variation depending on species or even within the same individual. We will not go into further detail about cell identification, but it is worth mentioning that identification of reptilian cells may be complicated sometimes, and it's not that easy as identifying the typical cells in dogs and cats. A veterinary nurse needs to know the different routes of drug administration available in reptiles. Intramuscular injections can be given in snakes in the apical muscles, that is, at each side of the spine. We need to inject in the area between scales, and we're going to see a video that is showing how to do this procedure of intramuscular injection in a snake. Those are the apical muscles at each side of the spine, and we need to inject between scales. Restraining is very important because the snakes move a lot. And then we're going to see another video, which is going to show the same procedure of intramuscular injection in a snake. All right, chelonians, similar to lizards, can be injected in the cranial or anterior femoral muscles. But there is also a large amount of muscles attaching the scapula to the plastron, and that's also a good place to give an intramuscular injection to a turtle or a tortoise. For a subcutaneous injection, we can use any area of loose skin. In turtles and tortoises, the prefemoral area is commonly used. In lizards, as we can see in this picture, there are several folds of skin along the lateral side of the body, where subcutaneous injections can be delivered. Subcutaneous injections in snakes are more complicated to give, as the skin is more attached to the underlying muscle, and the subcutaneous space doesn't accept large amounts of fluid. We have previously shown how to locate the heart for an injection. I only use it for euthanasia, and better with the animal under anesthesia. Intravenous catheter placement is complicated in reptiles. On most occasions, the skin will need to be incised in order to look for the vein. However, catheterization of the jugular may be easier in large tortoises, as we can see in this picture, or in this other one. See in the picture how we have previously made a cut in the skin before entering with the catheter. However, even in tortoises, the placement of IV catheters is difficult. Sometimes we can try to place and secure a butterfly catheter in a vein, as we are doing in this snapping turtle. However, in order to do this, the animal should be relatively large. Intraosseous catheters are a good alternative to IV catheters, and they're easier to place in lizards. Of course, this cannot be done in snakes, and it is a bit more complicated in the short bones of turtles and tortoises. However, using the tibia of lizards can give us good results. Many reptiles being attended in our clinic will be in a state of poor health, and they may need supplemental feeding. Let's review the ways we can do this. First, we need to say that for most animals that are not feeding by themselves, the placement of an esophagostomy tube is indicated. It is a simple procedure that any veterinary surgeon can do, and it can be used in chelonians, lizards, and snakes. A tube can be left in place for weeks. And once the tube is in place, giving oral fluids or giving oral medication becomes extremely easy. However, if an esophagostomy tube is not available, we'll need to restrain the reptile, open its mouth, and pass a tube into the stomach. And we're going to see that procedure in a tortoise. Take a look at this. We're using a hard needle, it's a feeding needle, just to go at the end of the esophagus and deliver the medication. When tortoises like these are sick, opening the mouth is easier. But for kind of healthy animals that are still have quite strength in the mandibles, sometimes getting the head out and opening the mouth is quite complicated. And that's why in tortoises that are not feeding, we use esophagostomy tube so much. When we do assisted feeding in a snake, we need to avoid damaging its mouth and teeth. They have 6 rows of teeth, and they can get damaged if we're not careful. They're delicate teeth. The microscope is commonly used when working with reptile patients, and not just for hematology. Parasites are common in many species, particularly those captured from the wild or those kept in soil with other reptiles. However, seeing parasites in reptiles is not equivalent to disease. In herbivorous reptiles, particularly tortoises, it's common to see plenty of eggs and even ciliates, such as the one we can see in this video. So sometimes we take a look at the microscope of a fecal sample from a tortoise, and it's like a whole ecosystem. That doesn't mean the animal needs to be treated. That doesn't mean the animal is deceased. We need to be careful with that. See, coccidian parasites may be more likely to cause disease. But even in these cases, again, microscopic findings should be interpreted together with the clinical signs. Just to end this webinar, there are other procedures in reptiles that may need to be done by veterinary nurses, such as enemas, radiographic positioning, intubation, etc. We will discuss just a few of them. Finding the heart with the aid of a Doppler is necessary to get heart rate previous and during anesthesia, and also to assess death after euthanasia. In chelonions, we can place the Doppler probe between the neck and the forelimb, directed towards the heart. Let's see, that's another example, but that's a soft shell turtles. And then in any other reptile, snake, lizard, or soft shell turtles, the Doppler is placed straight over the location of the heart. However, we should always remember what we're going to see in this video. And that's one thing you need to remember, and that the heart of reptiles can continue beating even after death. As we can see, we have, this is a dead snake or dead lizard, I don't remember. And then minutes or even hours after the reptile has been dead, the heart can continue beating. So we need to be careful with this when assessing when the animal is alive or dead, particularly after euthanasia. Intubation is another procedure that may need to be performed by a veterinary nurse, either for anesthesia or for resuscitation. Snakes and lizards have incomplete tracheal rings, which means we can use endotracheal tubes with a cuff. Turtles and tortoises have complete tracheal rings, which means cuffs from endotracheal tubes cannot be inflated. The glottis is always the base of the tongue. Many turtles and tortoises have a very short trachea, and we need to be careful not to intubate one bronchus, which will reduce oxygenation. So the ET tube needs to be advanced just a liter after the glottis. Placing microchips is another simple procedure in reptiles. There are some standardized places for delivering the microchip, and in chelonians is the left back leg. We need to remember that the skin of reptiles is not flexible, and after inserting a big needle, such as the one with the microchip, a hole, and we can see that hole here, a hole will be left. And therefore, this hole needs to be closed with either glue or suture. And basically, it's been a lot of slides showing you how to handle reptiles, how to restrain. I want you to know a bit about husbandry, which is very important when trying to hospitalize animals, feeding them. And I've shown you a few clinical techniques that are important for veterinary nurses to know when dealing with reptiles. This was actually the last slide of the webinar, the last slide of the presentation. And then now I'll be happy if you have any question, I'll be just happy to answer it. So there's a question here. You've mentioned Mediterranean tortoises may not be well adapted to the British climate. Should we stop recommending to keep this pet? This is actually a hot topic right now. There has been a recent and probably ongoing discussion in some UK journals, such as the Veterinary Record, about welfare and mortality in captivity for reptiles. The opinion on this topic may be personal, but there is some information I can give you that is quite objective. Mortality within the dealer is very high, according to some studies. Welfare of most captive reptiles seems to be poor. And the most important for me is that 20 years ago, we were describing that at least 50% of cases presented to the veterinary clinic were due to husbandry deficiencies. And we were hoping that that was going to change with time. Unfortunately, 20 years later, the situation nowadays is exactly the same, and most people still don't know how to care for these animals. So in my opinion, you should not encourage owners to keep reptiles. But remember, our duty as veterinary nurses and veterinary surgeons is to care for reptiles, not actually to recommend a pet for an owner. I hope that answers your question. There's another one. Can an iguana lose its tail voluntarily? I mean, like a gecko. Well, potentially yes, but it is far less common. In addition, as the animal ages, some tails become more mineralized, and the ability of losing the tail becomes more unlikely and difficult. However, I have seen an adult iguana losing its tail when someone grabbed the animal just by the tail in a very stressful situation. But remember, the ability to lose the tail depends, one, on the species, and two, on the age of that particular animal. And reptiles are more likely to lose the tail when they're young. Any more questions? Get this one type in one. There's another one here. How much subcutaneous fluid can we inject in a snake? Well, I don't like to give numbers, but the limit will be a physical question. That is, when you can no longer inject more fluid, or when you see that the lump that is forming under the skin is too big, then you need to stop. You can massage the area to distribute the fluid, but there will be a time where the plunger of the syringe doesn't advance easily. That's when you have to stop. And it's better to remember that than actually to remember a lot of numbers. And again, you'll see that each author or each book will recommend different numbers for that, because it's not something very objective. All right? Okay, is there any other question? No? Well, then thank you. Thank you very much. I hope you've learned a lot with this webinar, and have a good day.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank David for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.